The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show program for today, Tuesday. And Monday. I'm already, already a day off. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. And one of our favorite guests, Joe Carroll, is with us tonight. And I'll introduce the show in just a moment, but a couple of quick announcements. So one is a heads-up announcement. Our glorious power company, which has been role modeled after the power company in Caracas, Venezuela, has notified Northern California that about another 800,000 to a million people will be without power Wednesday, Thursday, and possibly a couple of days longer. So far, I'm not included in that batch, but the address is frequently changed, so I need to monitor it. So I will post a note on the website if we're going to go dark and cancel programs again. But so far, I think I will escape the grasp of the bureaucrats. It is a problem. I hope that many of our Bay Area, Northern California listeners will not be impacted by this, including my own family members. But that is a fact of life. So do pay attention. If you tune in to listen to a show and we're not there, look on the website for a power shutdown notice and you'll understand why we're not there. This is a full week of programming, and we have a Tuesday night program. We do Hotel Mars tomorrow. We're talking with Dr. Mike Wednesday. This is going to be a great night, Joe. Hotel Mars is Wednesday, and Dr. Mike Wall, who writes a lot for Space News, space.com, is with us about these weird Martian soil findings, and it should be a very interesting show. Thursday evening is a special program. I'm the only guest, and we're launching our 2019 annual fundraising campaign, which we do each year shortly before Thanksgiving. This is very important because it brings in the funding for the balance of this year and for operations for 2020. And I just want to take a moment to say great programming, like the one we're going to have in just a minute with Joe Carroll, who really is a beyond the normal routine, excellent guest who I've known for years and years and have had many off-camera, so to speak, discussions with. So I know the quality behind his words. That's all possible because many of you have funded the Space Show over the years and made guests like Joe and many others possible. So I do want to take the opportunity to deeply thank all of you who have done that and contributed, and let you know you're very much appreciated, and we hope you will stay with us and support us for our 19th year of the Space Show. But more about that for Thursday evening. You can call us with other things that are on your mind Thursday as well. We do have an open lines program on Sunday, but some of you may not be available on Sunday for that open lines. So if you want to call and treat Thursday as open lines as well, I'm perfectly fine with that, and our audience will be fine with that as well. Then we have our Friday morning Space Show program, and then again Sunday open lines. So it's a full week on the Space Show, and we're happy to share our time with all of you. We deeply appreciate your being here and your supporting the Space Show all of these years. I don't know what to say. I'm humbled by it. If you could see my sort of round and chubby face, it would probably be a little bit red right now. But let's move on. So tonight is a great special program with Joe Carroll. Our toll-free number, and we hope you will call us, is 1-866-687-7223. And email drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Note that we have posted PowerPoint presentation by Joe on the blog, and you will see it there for tonight's blog. I would suggest you open it, whether you're listening live or whether you're listening on archives, because Joe is going to be referring to a couple of those 29 slides. We're not going to do a PowerPoint presentation on the space show, but you will want to follow through with some of the slides that he points out to us. It is on the blog, and you shouldn't have any trouble finding it and opening and downloading that program. excuse me. On our website newsletter is there, and it's fresh for the week. It has everything in it that I've said a few minutes ago. And, you know, check it out. But also scroll down and see what we have planned through the balance of 2019. And you'll see we're now booking 2020 guests. And guess who we're going to have as a lead guest on 2020 when we come back from the holidays? January 3rd. Remember the show about genetic modification for human spaceflight a couple of weeks ago? And our guest who wrote the great article about it in Aerospace America introduced me to Dr. George Church, who has the Harvard Genetics Lab for Human Spaceflight Genetic Modification. And George has kindly agreed to come on the space show and talk about his lab, his work. And it won't be a reporter telling the story. It'll be George telling us the story, the guy who is actually doing this stuff. I can't think of a better way to start 2020. And let me again say, your gifts and your support to the space show have made all of this possible. And again, having George on the show, George Church on the show, is another way to say thank you to all of you who do support us. But we are filling first quarter 2020 dates right now. We've got a couple of shows available and that are open for 2019 in late December. And then we're off to the races for the new year. Remember that everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off the website or quickly download a show. Besides that website newsletter, our email newsletter by subscription, which is free, goes out by email 6 a.m., give or take a few minutes, California time, every Monday. If you would like to be included in that very brief newsletter, it just says who's on what date and what time, make sure I have your email address. It is gift-giving season. We do have a great store for the space show. Lots of space show paraphernalia, T-shirts, cell phone holders with space show logos and icons on it, dog clothes. Of course, there would be dog clothes on it, given the way I think about dogs. So check it out. Maybe you'll find a gift for your favorite space cadet or space show listener or your favorite pooch who's just yearning to go to Mars with all of you who want to go live on Mars. So feedback on our store is also welcome. To find it, click on any of our pictures on the website of Pepper listening to the space show, and Pepper will escort you into our Fifth Avenue Cafe Press store. Click up on the upper left to supporting the space show, and this is an important button because it takes you to instructions on how to listen to live programming like we're doing now, our website archives, which are highly compressed MP3s, and our podcast. And we are in lots of formats for the Apple format, for the Android format, and we're in generic podcasters like iHeartRadio and TuneIn. iTunes is now for the PC, as I understand it. If I'm wrong about that, people can correct me. We have Apple Podcasts, we have Overcast for Apple, and then Android apps as well. So if you have any podcasting issues or questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me, and I'll do my best to troubleshoot with you and do that. I alluded to it a few minutes ago, but do remember we are a listener-supported program. And again, we thank you, the listeners, for supporting us for these coming up on 19 years, the first part of June. And giving us guests like Joe and Dr. Church, who I mentioned a few minutes ago. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. If you're a federal U.S. taxpayer and a California taxpayer, you get tax deductions at both levels. And if you're not sure about that, You need to be paying U.S. federal taxes to get the federal tax deduction, and you need to be doing the same for California taxes to get a California state tax deduction. And again, if you have any questions, go to our parent 501c3 website, onegiantleapfoundation.org. Check it out. Ask me anything you want. The best way to reach me is email drspace@thespaceshow.com. If you're interested in being an advisory board member for 2020, you'll see that on the One Giant Leap website. So check it out, and if you do have that interest, let me hear from you. In addition to the individual podcasting, the individual contributions that I just talked about, there's a PayPal link center of our homepage, center right. That tells you how to donate to us electronically through PayPal. And it also tells you how to write a check to One Giant Leap and who to mail it to if you don't want to do electronic. We do have sponsors, and like I've been doing on a few shows, and instead of taking a three-minute break, I'm going to use the time to read our sponsor messages during our break time. And we're deeply appreciative of our sponsors, as well as each and every one of you who does support us and continues to support us. 19 years is a long time, and many of you have been with us that all that time, and saying thank you is hardly enough, but that's what I'm doing. I'm saying thank you, and looking forward to a great 2020 with all of you and your help and your support. Joe Carroll is our guest, and Joe has worked since 1981 on advanced space transportation, in mostly involving long tethers. He led the development of the Small Expendable Deployment System, SEDS, which demonstrated controlled deorbit without rockets in 1993, and he also flew successfully on SEDS-2 in 1994 and TIPS in 1996. He developed the deployer and wire for plasma motor generator, PMG, which demonstrated electrodynamic thrust in orbit. He has worked on unmanned and manned reentry vehicle concepts for NASA and several startups. His main current work is on electrodynamic tethers, and he has been probably our very, very best ever space show guest on artificial gravity for human spaceflight. And it is really a pleasure to have Joe with us. He presented at the IAC a couple of weeks ago. That is the PowerPoint that is loaded up on our website for Joe to talk about. Welcome back, Joe. How have you been? Joe, are you still there?
Yes. I'm here. You dropped off for us in about 2 seconds the end of that.
Well, I hope I'm not.
I'm here. I'm busy. I heard everything except for about 2 seconds at the end.
Well, hope that's not an omen for the connection for the rest of the show.
Yeah.
I know you got a CubeSat experiment going on, so let's start with that.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Okay, that's TEPSI, Tethered Electrodynamic Propulsion CubeSat Experiment, TEPCE. When you have a new project, you have to find enough vowels to make an acronym that's pronounceable. At any rate, that's the Naval Research Lab project, a 3U CubeSat. It was launched back in June as part of the STP-2 Falcon Heavy launch. But they've been checking it out and testing it, and just last Saturday morning in the early a.m. East Coast time, they commanded it to deploy. And based on the TLE orbit changes, the full 1 kilometer tether appears to have been deployed. We don't yet have any good imagery because we have onboard data, but it doesn't tell us everything we'd like to know, including the full deployed length. We do want to get some good images. TEPSI will not be as visible as SEDS-2 was back in 1994, but it will be in orbit for about the same time, about 2 months. After deployment, the drag, the orbit decay is about 5 to 30 times faster than it was before deployment, because even a thin tether that's a kilometer long is a lot more drag area than most satellites have. The reason I'm talking about it here now is that TEPSI, although it's now visible only in a modest range of latitudes, mostly in the tropics, starting in about 2 or 3 days, it's going to start to be visible through much of the U.S. So those who are familiar with Heavens Above website, go to that, load in your viewing site, and then look for TEPSI in the satellite database and see when you can see it. You'll probably need binoculars, and when it first comes into view, it'll be almost backlit in most cases and not visible, but during the pass, it'll get brighter and brighter, and it'll probably be brightest when it goes right before it goes into eclipse. But it's perhaps going to be the most interesting thing other than possibly ISS or a cluster of Starlink satellites before they spread out. People are not used to seeing things that are extended structures in space. And that was a big deal when that happened to SEDS 2. And I think that now that there are better telescopes and imaging capabilities, we don't yet have a good video. We don't have any video, but that may change in the next 24 hours. The Thai National Observatory is trying for it tomorrow night, which is in about 10 hours, I think.
I've used Heavens Above many times to track my my mom and dogs on a Celestis orbital mission, plus Bigelow's capsules that have my dog, a little bit of my dog on the Bigelow Genesis 2, I think is what it is. So I used Heavens Above quite a bit over the years. No matter where I am, I mean, I can be traveling and I put in that location and it'll tell me if it's going to be visible in that area. So
yeah.
And what time.
Now,
it's a great website.
Let me mention that the TLEs are transitioning. They're handling the radical change in drag area as a smooth transition. It'll probably be not very accurate for long-term predictions until maybe 3 days from now. But that's the time at which you really want to check to see where things are available
in the
U.S.
So toward the end of the week.
Yeah.
And how long does it stay up there? How long will we have a viewing possibility?
A month to 2 months, but actually the rest of November is the best time because it's in an eccentric orbit and it's higher over the U.S. now, and the evening viewing times are near the northernmost part of the orbit. That will not be true in December. So the best time is from, you know, a couple, the 21st or 22nd to the end of November.
So will it have your autograph or something on it so we'll know we're looking at the right thing?
If you see a long string, it's mine. And it was wound in my upstairs office here.
Really? Tell us how you wound it. What you say string, but obviously it's not string. What is the material?
It's actually Kevlar. It's a flat braid for the same mass and stowed volume. A flat braid has a bit more likely response to getting hit by micrometeorites. But it's a flat braid of 9 strands, 6 of plain Kevlar, and 3 of metal-coated Kevlar. We needed to have some conductivity from end to end, and it's about 1 to 2 ohms per meter. So it's actually you want to have some resistance, but you want to have conductivity. And we were able to find a company that could braid this and make a good length, continuous kilometer length without flaws or without needing to splice it.
So it's then, 1 kilometer in length?
Right. And it's wound on a cylindrical spool with a crisscross winding so it doesn't need flanges. And the way that it pays off, there's something called a stacer, which is like a very wide box spring, but instead of wanting to expand in diameter, it wants to push out in one direction. And so we put that in the inside of the spool of tether and then shot-putted one of the end masses out while keeping the tether at one end of the spring and the other end of the satellite at the other end. So it became a like a 6 foot long dumbbell. So that helped orient things to keep, well, it slowed down a slow spin before deployment. And in fact, that was useful data to know that deployment actually had occurred because the rate gyro data changed suddenly.
And it's
shot footed and then pulls the tether out. And when it gets to the end, the last 100 meters or so has very weak pieces of copper magnet wire that are bent into hooks to retard deployment. And I was interested in using adhesives, but I couldn't get an adhesive that was weak enough, and so I used this instead. So we don't know exactly whether the tether stops deploying when it runs into the hooks, it'll be 920 meters long. If it goes through all of the hooks, it'll be 1,030 meters long. It's somewhere between that, probably right near 1,000 meters.
Can I ask what the cost is of the tether?
The tether, actually, the coated material was expensive. I think it was like 40 cents per foot per strand. And so three strands, it was several thousand dollars just for the coated Kevlar. The fabrication of the stranded braid, which was much cheaper than buying the metal-coated Kevlar. It's a specialty item that's coated with nickel, then copper, then nickel, and the coatings are about a micron thick on a 14-micron fibers.
Did you design it yourself? Who actually did the design, or you had help doing
it? I came up with the idea, and we figured out how much room we had for the spacer and the tether, and decided that nine strands of 200 denier Kevlar would fit, but nothing longer, like a 11 or 13 strand, would fit and still fit a kilometer and deploy properly.
Well, I have a note to go out to toward the end of the week for Heavens Above and check it out for the next couple of weeks where I am. Hopefully it'll be visible for me. Do you know if it's early evening, late evening, in the middle of the night?
It'll be an hour after sunset roughly, and it will only be evening passes. The morning passes are all in the southern hemisphere for the next few weeks.
So when you say morning passes, like 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning? Or?
Oh, no. For anything that's in low Earth orbit, most of the time it's, not long after the sky gets dark. When in the morning, it's not long before the sky gets light. You won't get it in the middle of the night, except under very unusual circumstances.
So, Joe, if it flies over Northern California and PG&E has removed our power, will we still be able to see it? Will those bastards reach out to Leo and try to affect Leo too?
one of the companies that wants to image it has some suitable telescopes with mounts that can track it accurately. At Sierra remote observatories near Shaver Lake.
Okay.
That's at about a 37-degree north latitude, and that's near the end of, you can't be at 45 degrees and get a good view.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll let you know if I go see it. I'll go check it out. So, listeners, and if you go see it, post it on the blog and let us know, okay? And I do have binoculars, so maybe that'll help.
And actually, if anybody gets some good images or even poor images, send them to tepsiflight@gmail.com. and we'll make sure that they and you know, indicate your name, et cetera. We can credit it to you, but we'd like to see any pictures you are able to get.
Okay, cool. So you go to IAC to talk about, what humans are going to do with gravity on Mars or the Moon, or no gravity, or microgravity, or some gravity. You know, Jim Logan, who I know you know real well, has always said there's going to be zero human spaceflight if we don't figure out the gravity prescription for humans. And I, as far as I know, and doing this show for 19 years, and Jim is just coming back on the show, and of course you saw him up in Seattle, there still is no gravity prescription for humans. So tell us about your IAC presentation. And you say in it there are only two gravity levels, 0.09 to 0.09 in our solar system, and Mars or Moon enough for our health. So are they? What do you think?
Well, those of you who have the presentation, look at slide 2.
Okay.
Because slide 2 and slide 3 have the graphics that really you want to think about.
Yeah, I'm on slide 2.
Forget about anything else. Remember those graphics. Gravity in this solar system is clustered, and there are three gravity levels that matter. It's rather surprising that five of the planets are close to 1G. Earth, Venus, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are all within 12% of Earth gravity, okay? That is real convenient if you want to go live there. Unfortunately, none of those places are good candidates for going and living there in the near term. I mean, Venus is too hot. The other ones are too heavy, so if you go there, the delta V to come back is about 2 to 3 times that of Earth, and so it's going to be a one-way trip. And they also, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune don't have real surfaces. And realistically, with all of those, you have to learn how to float. And if you're going to try and do that, I would suggest people actually trying to do that in the Earth stratosphere first. Find out if that's a viable place to go. Because if so, you may be able to have a chance to live on Venus, Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune. Okay? But there's a lot of work on that, okay, to be done. So the next gravity level is Mars. And it's rather surprising, but Mars and Mercury have within 1% the same gravity level. And then when you look for the next cluster, it's roughly clustered around Earth's moon, about 1/6 G. And that applies not just to our moon, but to the other five large moons in the solar system. They're all within about 0.12 and 0.18 gravity, and our moon is 0.16. So the question is, if you're going to live somewhere other than the planets that you'd have to float in the atmosphere at 0.9 to 1.1 G, what kind of effects will there be at roughly Mars gravity or roughly Moon gravity? We don't know. We know that 12 guys spending 1 to 3 days on the Moon, there was no problem. But we also know that people can live in microgravity and survive it, although every time people stay longer, we find new problems. And when the database increases and when we start measuring things that we hadn't measured before, we find problems. We really don't know, as Jim Logan says, we don't know the prescription for long-term human health, that we don't know the gravity prescription. It could be close to 1G. It could be moon gravity or Mars gravity, but we don't know. So that's the real challenge, is we've learned a lot about what people can do in space, but we do know that microgravity is not good for long-term human health, and it imposes lots of problems, like you have to do 2 hours a day of vigorous running to get the kind of exercise that you get lying in bed in 1G.
So are you aware of any work going on to determine the human gravity prescription, or is it just out there as talk for right now?
There are things that people have tried to do, you know, bed rest, tilted bed rest, things like that.
Uh-huh.
And bed rest isn't the great thing. A great thing. I mean, it's the best thing you can do, but you don't even know how good a test it is. But you do know that bed rest is a problem. I mean, I had 2 weeks of bed rest after back problems 30 years ago, and I was pretty dizzy when I stood up after 2 weeks of bed rest. I'm sure that now that I'm 30 years older, that it would be much more of a problem.
Yeah, you wouldn't even stand up probably now, Joe. So.
Yeah. But then within a day, I was able to walk down to the beach a couple blocks away. The recovery was fairly fast.
I was going to say, do you think Jim is right, or is it an extreme statement? Can we do long-term, long-duration human spaceflight without knowing the gravity prescription, or is it just too risky?
It depends on the risk. I mean, for example, during the Apollo program, the astronauts were ready to fly on the Atlas and the Mercury when it had not yet been successfully tested under relevant conditions. But the Russians were ahead of us, and they were willing to take a chance because that was a big deal. Okay, it was a prestige thing.
Right.
I don't see anything remotely resembling that today. You know, people talk about, oh, the Chinese go. Well, you know, if running to the moon to get there before the Chinese is the next thing, 50 years from now, is it going to be, you know, running to get there before the North Koreans or Albanians? I don't think it makes sense. And realistically, the Apollo program, from the beginning, they specified how much it was going to cost. And it was planned to be funded during an 8-year administration. Most of the retries to go do space exploration since then have been kind of kicking the budget to future administrations. Now, this one claims that by 2024, there will be people and women, guys and women on the moon. That's new, okay, from the post-Apollo mindset. But I'm not sure that nobody's told us what the budget is and whether that will be acceptable to Congress and the public. I don't know.
I don't know either. I think they should come up with a realistic budget so we know what we're getting into.
Yeah, and part of the problem is the actual target keeps changing. You know, it's Mars, then it's the moon, then it's, say, Gateway, then it's back to the moon. You can't have a variable target and then specify a budget and get it taken seriously.
I have a question for you from a listener. Okay.
Yes.
So this is Josh, and Josh is in Wichita, Kansas. And he says, Joe, do you know of any proposals being put forth to NASA or any other agency capable of doing space research to do artificial gravity or to test for gravity prescriptions or anything related to the kinds of things your work focuses on and what you're going to be talking about tonight?
NASA seems relatively allergic to artificial gravity in concept. I think that it is actually a well-thought-out objection, and that is that people think of microgravity as the thing that NASA does. And if we start saying, oh, we need to fix that, you know, there are some congressmen that don't have NASA centers. In fact, there are more people that don't have NASA centers in their districts than that do. And they can say, realistically, well, if microgravity is a problem, maybe we ought to just come home. And so that's a reasonable supposition from a program manager's point of view. But realistically, we know that although we can live in microgravity and we can put Band-Aids on it so that the degradation slows down, but we don't have a fix that says we can stay long-term or that people can live on much less gravity. We know really nothing about partial gravity. And in fact, it took a while after I came up with this idea of a spinning asymmetrical dumbbell that can provide Mars gravity and lunar gravity at opposite ends, with each being the counterweight for the other. I didn't realize at first that the key was not artificial gravity, but partial gravity, because there's no way to test that makes sense, that's realistic on the ground. You can test hypergravity by putting people in a tilted centrifuge so that they get more than 1G. And there apparently have been tests on chickens and other things to get significantly higher gravity levels. But you can't do those tests at less than 1G. And so we can't find out on Earth, to the best of my knowledge, I know of no way to do tests on human, the impacts of partial gravity on humans without doing it in space with a spinning system.
And
all the details are secondary.
And I
know of no way to do that on the ground.
And do you know of any proposal to do this in space? I mean, you know, where they're asking for money, where they're trying to do it?
There have been other concepts to test artificial gravity. There's a guy from NASA Ames that wants to put a circular train on a circular track and have people exposed to, you know, the rotation effects in partial more than 1G experience. But, and I know that a report by Joosten, J-O-O-S-T-E-N, looked at a artificial gravity vehicle to go to Mars, and the real thing is that it was trying to use a necessary counterweight that was a nuclear reactor plus shadow shield that would block the radiation from the crew, and you put the crew at the other end of that and spin it up. It was really an attempt to use the added mass of concentrated mass of a nuclear reactor more than an attempt to actually come up with a good design for an artificial gravity vehicle to reduce the amount of muscle degradation and other problems we find on the space station while the crew is in transit to Mars and back. So those are the two that I know about. There are studies, there are folks at MIT and elsewhere that have rotating facilities that can test rotation rate of artifacts. But my friend Jim Charles, John Charles, who used to be the lead person on bioastronautics at NASA JSC. He was the one that pointed out to me that the artifacts that you get testing rotation rates in 1G are at right angles to those that you get in a facility where the rotation provides your gravity. And we simply don't know whether the effects are going to be the same. So we really need to do tests to find out what rotation rate is acceptable to most people. And you can't really necessarily decide that you can test people on the ground for other things to find out whether they will tolerate relatively large spin rates in space. You really have to do the test separate in space to get the artifacts that you want to test. So to answer the question, there are bits and pieces of work. If you look at the artificial gravity website that Ted Hall has put together, Ted is an architect who's very interested in artificial gravity and has thought through the implications more than most people have. His website collects a bunch of things that NASA and others and I have put together. So anybody wants to get up to speed on artificial gravity, I would strongly suggest you go to Ted Hall's website, just artificial gravity. I don't know if there's a dash in it or not, but if you just do a web search for artificial gravity, you'll get to his website fairly quickly.
So what are you telling us? What did you tell the IAC audience? It sounds almost like we're stymied. And by the way, let me make a call out. Listeners, we'd love to get your phone calls, 1-866-687-7223. And email, of course, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. What did you conclude with IAC? I mean, it seems almost like the work being done here on Earth is almost not relevant because we need to get up in space to do the work.
Yeah, and doing stuff in space is expensive, and doing stuff with people in space that you haven't done before, there's a lot of head scratching and paranoia and people who don't think through the problems, getting excited about problems that may or may not be real. But it is hard to get new things done in space. Now, to get back to the 1960s and, what's the priority of doing important things, the Gemini program was a very peculiar program because it actually started after Apollo, about a year after Apollo, and it was really set up to answer four questions, which I won't go into in detail, that they wanted answered before they started flying people in Apollo. One critical one was, can people handle 2 weeks in microgravity without problems? And they did. Well, Gemini went through those four critical issues quickly enough that the folks at JSC started looking for things to do on the last few missions because they had gone through most of them well before Gemini 11 and 12. And so my friend Dave Lang, who was at JSC, his boss walked into his office one day and said, we're thinking of doing some kind of tether experiment on Gemini 11 or 12. Can you look into it? Well, Gemini 11's slow spin tether experiment flew less than a year later. Okay. We don't do things that way now. You can't even get a contract started in that time frame. But it could be done. It could be done if somebody like Elon Musk wanted it to happen. He could do interesting tests on the way to taking crews to the space station with the Dragon 2.
Why doesn't he want to do it? Have you ever talked to him about it?
I haven't talked with him. I have sent him papers to some of his people some years ago, but I have not pressed it, and I should. I really should. If there's a SpaceX person here, please contact me, and let's you're interested, let's talk about it.
Boeing's going to go to the space station too. What about pressing them?
Yes, I should do that as well. I'm in San Diego, and SpaceX is a 2-hour drive, and Boeing is, I don't know where they're doing that work, but they're not close,
they're not close.
In or near L.A.
Yeah, they're not close to
but
L.A.
Yes, I should definitely check those out, and perhaps some others when they, Blue Origin, I think may be interested. I've talked with a couple of their folks, but I've been juggling other things recently and haven't pursued that one. But yeah, that's.
So, I hear when I talk to people, and I don't think they really know, but there's A, number one, they're SpaceX fanboys and girls. And I'm not saying that to belittle them, but they're really strong SpaceX supporters and believers. Number two, they really, really like Starship. And so they talk about Starship going to Mars with all these people on board and the mission and all of this. And they either assume that it will somehow spin or that it will work with tethers or that there'll be some kind of artificial gravity or partial gravity system on board. Nobody really knows, and nobody really knows if these systems would even work to help humans on, say, a Mars mission. So, and you don't hear much from SpaceX about what they're going to do on the way to Mars. Or if you do, I haven't heard it. I may have missed it. So if you look at all of this, and, you know, you're kind of maybe a congressman on the cusp of liking space, but do you really want to fund anything? Or maybe, you know, you're a space advocate or somebody and you want to see space settlement or humans in space. You kind of scratch your head, Joe, and you say, where is this gravity prescription that Logan's talking about? How are you going to do this with humans? Who's got a viable plan? Who's got a viable system on their spacecraft? And it seems like you come up with a lot of exuberant wishful thinking and designs, but you don't have anything for real. Or what am I missing?
I don't know. I noticed some time ago that as you look to larger launch vehicles, the cost per pound tends to go down. However, when you get to the largest, highest capacity vehicle in each country's inventory, the cost per pound often goes up. I mean, Titan's cost, back in the day where we were flying lots of pre-EELV vehicles, Titan's cost more per pound than Atlas's, and they were much bigger. I think that's true in the Russian side. I don't know about ESA or Long March, but the largest vehicle has some monopoly capabilities, and the builders of those vehicles know that. And so there should be a economy of scale of larger vehicles costing less per pound. But when they fly infrequently, there's a cost there. And when they're the only ones that can bid on a particular payload, that raises costs. So I'm not sure that the Starship is going to actually be a affordable, cheaper per pound payload. And by the way, one of the interesting things about the smaller end where the larger vehicles cost less, there's also an insight in that it took a long time for me to notice, and that is that small payloads are worth more to get into specific orbits than large payloads. And that's true because the customers for those launch vehicles pay the higher cost per pound. So there's a range of prices, and the puzzlement is whether Starship is going to fit that curve or fit the pattern of the largest vehicle in a country's inventory to actually cost more because of monopoly pricing. I don't know whether, you know, I think Elon doesn't want that to happen, but I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
In addition, it's nowhere near as mature. The change from one material to stainless steel.
Right.
Yeah, Atlas did that too. Okay. But I don't know that he's thought through the full implications because Atlas goes one way. It does not survive reentry. Starship, we'll see.
You have a caller on hold. Let's see who wants to talk to you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you?
Hi, Joe. This is Doug from Redlands, California.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hello.
So, David, just to let you know, Joe and I, it seems like every conference, every space conference that I go to, I end up going to lunch with Joe, and we just really talk. It's really enjoyable if I talk for an hour over lunch, so about these sorts of things. So he's just fun, really fun to talk to. So, Joe, back to artificial gravity. So, would you – I want to get at when and where do we need to know the gravity prescription and which gravity prescriptions. There's not just one. So I would say there's gravity prescription for adult health, for healthy gestation, and healthy childhood. Is that
yes.
right? Those are the three?
And by the way, you should – say that your interest is in getting colonies or settlements to be economically independent as early as possible, and that drives you to the gestation issues rather than retired people on Mars issues.
Not actually. It's technically,
okay.
Technically independent, not necessarily financially. Those are different things. And I think that there is a logical path, and I don't think jumping all the way to reproduction is the first step. I think we need to reduce transportation costs by producing stuff using local resources, such as water for propellant. Anyhow, back to artificial gravity. So what I would say, those are the three artificial gravity prescriptions that we need: adult health, gestation, and childhood. Okay, but we need to know those things at different times, and I think this is what people are sort of forgetting. Do we hold off on going to the moon until we figured out the artificial gravity prescription for gestation and childhood in low Earth orbit in some sort of artificial gravity station? I would say why. We can start with sending adults to the moon, and we can use indoor centrifuges, which is not full gravity all the time, but it is full gravity for maybe 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening. So I think we need to bear in mind that it's not always, you know, Logan loves to talk about, well, if we're not doing settlement, then what are we going for? Well, you don't start with settlement. You start with going to the moon, and there's probably an international lunar exploration phase there that's using adults. So could you address, you know, when do we need to know which of these prescriptions?
Messy sorts of questions that are kind of orthogonal to what I've been thinking about mostly, but that's a good question. To my mind, for example, Elon wants to retire on Mars. I think that it would be much better to do tests for the implications of that in Earth orbit. And I will even go so far as to say that for doing tests at lunar gravity, I think it's better to do that on Earth because you can do far more people at far lower cost with infinitely better diagnostics because you can, if you're spinning in low Earth orbit, you can throw things down every day. You know, by the time you launch medical diagnostics equipment, it is obsolete. And the technician is an astronaut whose time costs $1,000 an hour or more 1,000 times as much as a technician analyzing stuff on the ground. I really think that we, the kind of facility that I envision in low Earth orbit, an asymmetrical dumbbell that provides Mars gravity and lunar gravity at opposite ends, that should be focused primarily on human health in that environment. And you're going to be sending people up for a long time. You're going to be sending technicians up to fix equipment. There are going to be a lot of people running through, and some of them are going to stay for a year or even several years. If we find that we don't have the problems that we have in microgravity in 1 year, we don't find those at Mars or moon gravity, the next thing is to find out, well, how long can you stay? And that actually gets to a very interesting case of Al Globus's argument for doing stuff, early settlements in near equatorial orbit, I mean, within 10 degrees of the equator.
Joe?
Yes?
Yeah, I want to clarify.
You want to get me back to your question? Yes.
Well, you said some things, but you said, like, we should learn about the effects of lunar gravity on Earth, I mean, on the surface of the Earth, or
oh no,
Earth?
No, no, on in LEO.
Okay, in LEO. So the thing is
spinning.
Not...
Yeah, yet the effect of lunar gravity, and by the way, that means as opposed to the artifact of tracking abrasive dust in and getting complications that. You know, you can make that impossible, but you can't make that impossible affordably early on. And so if you're actually on the moon, you're testing lunar gravity and lunar regolith health problems.
Yeah, so I'd like to encourage you to go to my website, developtrace.info/dust, and I deal with the problems of dust at each area that it is a problem. And I don't see the need to be tracking dust into the habitats. But I'd like to sort of put that aside and get back to the artificial gravity. So right now, we've got a named program. We've got Artemis. We've got a partial budget towards that. We've got, you know, contracts going out for the different, you know, for gateway modules as well as for lunar landers. So there is a commitment and even a set date for establishing a permanent base on the surface of the moon, and we could do, using an indoor centrifuge, we could go ahead and start testing in the final environment for the moon, which is the moon, whereas we don't have funding, we don't have a named program for an artificial gravity facility in LEO. So what I'm saying is, since we're going to the moon, why don't we do the research at the final destination, which is the moon?
It just costs 10 times or more doing it there than in doing it LEO. That's the main disadvantage. Yes, I agree that there's no budget to do it at all. And at the current rate, that will never occur. Okay? I'm trying to get people to start thinking about that differently. Should we do it, given that the cost difference of doing it on the moon, the cost of getting people to and from the moon is far higher. I'm guessing factor of 10, but I suspect it's much more than that. But I don't know. What is the cost difference of getting people to the space station or to a near equatorial orbit compared to getting them on the moon, not just to run around the moon and come back home, but to get on the moon and then to come back home?
It depends on if we're producing propellant on the moon. That could dramatically reduce the cost. And we don't know that right now.
Are you suggesting that that will reduce the cost of return or also the cost of getting onto the moon?
You could produce descent propellant on the moon, and you could ship it up and use it on descent.
I have worried whether these schemes, when you actually look at them, you know, fixing things that break and all that stuff, and actually delivering, using propellant to get propellant to lunar orbit. Yeah, I'm sure it can be made to work, but will it actually work economically? I don't know.
So there are resources in the moon. There's not resources in LEO. And so I think for if you...
Well, there are 2,000 tons of debris that could be collected.
Yeah, but then that's another complication of collecting that debris and getting into the right orbit, the
yeah.
right plane.
It is a challenge, but it is a... It's an unconventional propulsion challenge, but it can be done. TEPSI may be able to clarify the feasibility of that in the next two months.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and free up the line so other people can call in.
Hey, Doug, I have
yeah.
a question for you.
Oh, sure.
Maybe I don't know, but tell me one fuel-making operation on the moon that has been completed and what the actual bona fide certified cost factors are in doing that.
Well, David, you know that is not happening.
Well, then that is as hypothetical as Joe's doing debris.
Well,
I'm sorry,
no,
Doug.
No. You're putting things in black and white. Like
yes, I am. I am. And if I were doing the budget at the whatever that budget agency is called for, and to come up with cost factors to tell Congress what this is going to cost, or if SpaceX was having their auditors go do this, they would look at it in a black and white way too. Just like probably the cost of reusability until you really go out and do it and know what they are, you don't really know. And they may be better than you think, and they may be worse than you think.
So do take into account things like Roxygen, which is the developed technology.
But
you know,
but not on the moon, and what it would take to do it and what it would cost to do it and the servicing and maintenance. You're changing the environment for doing this stuff, right?
Changing which environment?
Well, you're going from manufacturing things here on Earth to doing something in an environment you've never worked on before.
But if you
let me actually break in on that. Australian miner told me he's very interested in extraterrestrial mining, et cetera, but he says that water is used almost everywhere in mines on Earth, and that will not be available in most places when you're doing stuff on the moon or Mars, or, well, Mars that may change, but there are a few places on the moon where there will be ice. How much, we don't know. You can't regard it as an infinite resource.
Yeah, it's one part per 18 in Kabaeus crater. We know that.
I'm not saying, Doug, that it's not feasible, possible, or even that it's not cost-effective. I'm just saying it's a totally unknown thing. So to me, if you've got everything about it as unknown and untested, even though theoretically it makes great sense, you still don't know. And there's a lot of surprises ahead.
But since we need to quantify the degree of unknown, it's not just, what in Boolean, it's not, either completely unknown or completely known and proven in the final state. It's like TRL levels are a gradient, and we need to believe physics too. So we understand the environments of the moon and Mars, and we can reproduce those environments, including partial gravity in the Vomit Comet. But we can certainly, abrasive regolith, temperature, vacuum, time delay, communications, all these sorts of things. We can do that,
We know those things. We don't know what things we don't yet know.
And it
may not be a problem, but it may be.
I don't even think it's a problem. I just am saying that your costs are unknown. You can't go manufacture fuel in the Vomit Comet. Well, maybe you can, and I don't know because I'm not an engineer.
On a scale model...
on a scale.
You can.
Well, I'll let listeners use their own discernment here, but I think it's I'm not saying it's not possible. Don't anyone say I'm being negative. I'm just saying it's a big unknown. So if you want to talk cost and feasibility and bringing fuel up from the moon to get back down to the moon, I'd say, man, somebody's got to have some really sharp pencils to work that one out.
But it's sort of like supersonic retropropulsion. People are saying it hasn't been done. There could be all sorts of problems. SpaceX ran the simulations, and then they used some of their launches, you know, sort of a side research project, and they did it.
Yeah, but we're not saying, Doug, it's not possible to do. I'm arguing that the costs are so unknown, and don't forget supersonic propulsion and what SpaceX did. They did here in an Earth manufacturing environment. We've manufactured in space before. We've done things on the space station. We got 3D printers in the space station. We do know some things that we can do, but we haven't made fuel yet, either in orbit or on the surface of the moon. And I'm just saying those costs are you can extrapolate them and estimate them, and you can be as accurate as you want, and you may find a lot of surprises.
There's cost and there's also the technical, and those are two different issues. I agree.
Yeah, and listeners, don't think I'm telling Doug that it's not possible. That's not what I'm saying at all. I think it is possible to do what he said. I just think when you pro forma it out, you may not want to do it. You may want to look for another solution.
I think that it's important to start doing things where you look for solutions that are known and say, okay, we can do this, or we think we can, that this may work.
But then
when you finish putting all those pieces together, you need to hand it off to somebody who's a sharp pencil kind of engineer,
right,
who can tell you, oh, this is going to be painful. This may not work at all. What are your backups on this one? Because I don't believe that part of the miracle. You need that part of the skeptical engineer to look at it. It doesn't mean that he's right, but you need what some people refer to as a wire brush scrub from your initial designs that are conceptual.
Absolutely.
We all would agree with that. Does anyone know what the plan is for landers at the gateway to get fuel to go to the moon and then come back? Are they taking it from the moon, or what is the fuel situation on landers on the gateway to and both to the moon and from the moon? I don't know, so I'm asking somebody to help tell me what it is, Doug. What are they planning?
So they're going to start with commercial deliveries to the gate station, commercial deliveries of propellant to the gate station.
From Earth.
Gateway.
From Earth. Okay.
And that's a sort of a safe thing to do. And then as a contingency, then of course the gateway can receive propellant from the moon if they are able to produce it from the moon. And if that's the case, then there is the possibility that that would be a cost savings, because now you don't have to ship all the way through. Boy, what is it going to be, about 14 kilometers, a delta V of 14 kilometers a second to get propellant to the gateway versus 2.5 kilometers per second.
So then we'll have the answer to what you and I have been discussing, if they actually build the gateway and do it. So we'll get the answer that we all want.
Right, exactly.
With a little
Let me put my Tether hat on here and say that tethers are one-shot use tethers are good for fractional kilometer per second delta Vs. Reusable tethers can do that for 1 kilometer to 1.5 kilometer per second delta Vs. And when you're looking at things going into moons and Mars orbit and stuff like that, delta V differences of 1 or 2 kilometers a second are huge differences. The fact that people are talking about doing this all with rockets means, to my mind, they haven't thought about it yet, because if they think about it, they will start using tethers wherever they can. The unusual thing about a tether, when you reuse a rocket, you don't reuse the propellant. Tethers allow you, in many cases, to reuse the reaction mass, okay, because you don't throw it away. And if you've got traffic in both directions, and you've got, 1 to 2 kilometer per second delta Vs, you're crazy to not be using a tether there.
Okay.
End of harangue.
Doug, anything else, or do you want to clear
no,
the
let
line?
Me, let me free up the line for you. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Call on open lines, Doug. We'd like to hear from you.
I appreciate that. Thanks, David.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Listeners, I'm going to pause for a break that we should have had about 20 minutes ago. But because my time management has been so superb here on this show, I'm going to treat our sponsors as if we're doing the shorter segment, and I'm just going to give a shout-out to them so we can continue talking to Joe and taking your phone calls and your emails. So I do want to call out and shout-out to Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, our new sponsor, Astrox, A-S-T-R-O-X, A-I-A-A, Moonwords, the Space Development Network, which is what Doug has, who just called, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan with the Integrated Space Group. So we wouldn't be doing this program without their great support and their friendship, and we really are appreciative of our sponsors. We hope they'll all come back next year. I'll be asking them now that we're about to start our annual campaign. And we're going to open up for sponsors in 2020, and we only take a few because they do eat into talk time for the guests. So if you're interested and want this per-show recognition, do let me hear from you. Also, callers, let me give out the phone number again. We still have plenty of time if you want to follow Doug's call, 1-866-687-7223. Joe, what I'm kind of at a loss here. So we want to go to Mars. We want to go back to the moon, and we're kind of going blindfolded. So what can we do about that so we unmask ourselves and we go a little bit better prepared?
Well, we could take seriously Jim Logan's challenge, which is, do we know whether we have a future to live on the moon or on Mars? Now, he does point out that you can visit there, but you can't live on them. You have to live in them. You will be a high-tech cave boy. We need to live under some meters of shielding. And, Earth's atmosphere provides shielding that's equivalent to roughly 10 meters of water. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And maybe 5 meters of rock or something like that. It depends slightly on the atomic species, et cetera. But you need meters of material over you to have the doses, the cosmic ray doses screened down to low enough levels that you don't have problems. And I was actually surprised to find that the cosmic ray doses on space station are a significant part of the total. And going to equatorial, very near equatorial, within 10 degrees of the equator, not 28.5. 28.5 is roughly as bad as 51.6, because the South Atlantic anomaly fries. I mean, the Hubble telescope, every time it goes through the South Atlantic anomaly, it degrades its capability for a couple hours for the CCDs, et cetera. Well, that happens to people as well. But right near equatorial orbit, that's an attractive place. And I actually looked recently and talked with people from Brazil and Singapore. If you were going to launch sites that are real close to the equator, you can launch from Kourou or Brazil, Alcantara launch site, or sites near Singapore, which is a real high-tech area, more high-tech than most in Indonesia. But the land that you would go, the water that you go over launching from near Singapore, you are close to land most of the way, which has some advantage for downrange abort options. But you fly over bits of multiple bits of Indonesia, and so you would have to work out a deal. The Space Liability Convention, 1972 Liability Convention, says that the launching the state that launches the that provides the payload, that provides the rocket, and provides the launch site, all are launching states and can be sued for any losses to other states on the ground or to aircraft in flight. And that needs to be worked out with Indonesia if they're going to fly from there. Brazil, if you're launching from there, the unfortunate thing is there's nothing for you to abort. Downrange abort landings are right in the middle of the Atlantic, and there are no islands nearby and things like that. So there are challenges to launching serious facilities in near equatorial orbit, but they, I think, are workable. I mean, Kourou could be used to launch to roughly 5.5 to 7 degree inclination orbits. That orbit provides much better shielding. In fact, the total radiation dose in that orbit is, you can spend 5 to 7 years in that orbit before you get the same total dose that Kelly got in 1 year in ISS at the same altitude. And that is a significant advantage. If we're going to get serious about finding the long-term effects of partial gravity, we probably want to think about stays longer than a year, and you want to do that in that orbit.
Do we have the technical capability to go do that today?
Yeah, if you launch from Kourou. Okay. There are a couple other sites that there was a converted oil platform off Kenya that was used at like 0.5 degree south inclination, I think. But Kourou is the place to start if you're going to think doing that. But if you want to do a commercial thing, it may make sense to start, you know, Singapore and Indonesia, do a deal. Or Brazil.
But what would you put the Kourou in? What would be their orbiting vehicle? Your dumbbell?
You'd start with that. Now, Al Globus, if you look at the stuff that he's done, just Al Globus, if you do web search for him.
He's on the show frequently about his plans.
Yes,
he's coming
yes.
back on next month, too.
Yeah, if you look at the papers that he's done starting around 2017, he's been focused on that, and I think he's onto something. And the earliest settlement candidates may be there, and those might actually be, you know, O'Neill kind of things that would be pretty large and expensive. But before you do that, you want to find out what's the rotation rate that you want for something like that. And, you know, O'Neill assumed that we're in the indefinite future and, you know, when people can do a lot of stuff in space, you know, if you can do this at all, you can do it in the kilometer size and reduce the spin rate to low values. But if you're going to do it early, well, you start with a dumbbell because it's the thing that gives you the longest radius for the least mass. You know, when you compare it with a donut is, you don't get to use it until you build the whole damn thing. The Von Braun donut was a great thing for building programs, but a dumbbell you can test with one launch with a spare spent stage counterweight and you can start doing useful tests for people to find out what the spin rate artifacts are and how many people are bothered by them.
How many people would you need to have in that first test, first type of system?
Well, the current design for the Dragon 2 and the Boeing equivalent are, you know, of order 7 people. That's not a bad number to start with. But I think it's let me go out in a brief harangue. I don't think that there's ever been an actual launch vehicle or crewed space vehicle that's been operational and flew people that got close to 1 ton per person, which was Mercury almost got, okay? By the time they got to Apollo, they were adding all sorts of things that they thought were necessary, and they wanted, you know, that was 6 tons for the capsule for 3 people, and that's not including the service propulsion module, which is like 40 tons or more. I'm surprised that the current vehicles are designed for only 7. I think it was based on the space station allegedly being designed for 7, but it's handled 13 people in it. Okay, when it had 6 people plus a shuttle crew of 7. So, you know, the limiting factor in the space station is probably the CO2 removal in the exercise facility. When they first designed that place, I doubt that they appreciated that they were going to have crew members running 2 hours a day, and there's only one place to do that. So that's using up 14 hours a day. But the space station could handle a dozen people and still have 2 hours a day for each person in that. I don't think that anybody, I've talked with people and they misunderstand the question. When I say, what is the capacity of the space station? They say 7. I think it could be more. Now, Mark Kelly brought up problems with CO2 removal and the fact that NASA didn't like to run two of them side they like to have one as a backup. They need to fix that problem, okay? But I think that the space station could handle a larger capacity, and I think that the launch vehicles could handle more than 7 people in a, you know, 10 to 15 ton manned vehicle. If you're designing from the beginning to take people a short distance and have them get off within a few hours or go home, you can design it as a bus rather than as a motorhome. And NASA hasn't thought about that. But if you want to have a facility that is really aimed at understanding people's effects in 2 gravity levels, you want to have a bunch of people there. And the simplest way to reduce the costs is really to fit more people in a vehicle than you do now. I think it can be done. I'm an expert on that, but I have looked into it to some extent.
I have another listener email for you. Sharon is in Chicago, and she says, Joe, have you gotten together with Al Globus? Do you have a plan or a proposal to try to implement, raise the money for it to actually do this? Or is everything just a kind of planning, but there is no real action being presented to make it happen?
Well, Al and I are both semi-retired. And, you know, I don't know his exact age, but I'm 72. He's close to that.
Oh, we're about the same age. I didn't know we
were. Excuse me?
I said we're about the same age. I didn't know we were that close together. Yeah.
And I'm doing this because I want this stuff to be taken seriously. I'm not trying to start something that will be, you know, my main business for 10 years or whatever. I just want to light a fire under people. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I have some insights that need to be taken seriously, but, you know, when I go and give a talk at IAC, I'm hoping that I'm in the right place, but when I finish my talk and there are only one or two questions, I'm not sure I'm in the right place.
Is that what happened? You only got one or two questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have
now,
time?
Part of that is I used more of my time, of the total time available, but I did leave time for a couple of questions, and there wasn't much. And it was near the end of a session, and I said, anybody that wants to go for lunch? It ended up being one guy. He was very interested, and I hope to stay in contact with him, but there was only one person.
It's such a big forum, it just may not be the right forum for question and answer. Like your comments at the Space Studies Institute, did you get comments and questions there when you presented a talk at the SSI?
Well, that was a session that I think was the most important session. And, you know, there were Jim Logan, John Charles, me, and a woman named Morgan Irons who looked at long-term stuff from a evolutionary ecological point of view. And I think we brought up key issues. And I think that that kind of discussion needs to be pursued in a range of venues. John Charles knows some of the right people. Jim Logan, they know more of the groups of people that may be interested in hearing about this and perhaps raising some hell over it. Well, and they're both retired now, so they are freer to speak their minds.
Jim will be back on the show in December. I keep trying to get John Charles to come back on the show, but he never responds to emails, so I've given up. And Morgan will be on the show in a couple of weeks. So I'm.
Yeah, I thought that was a good session.
We'd like to see it move forward, and I guess the listeners are like me. They're probably at a loss to know how to accomplish some real progress on the gravity prescription. Are we going to do artificial gravity? What is it going to look like? Are we going to do partial gravity? What is it going to look like? What are the effects on people? Doug's questions for the different kinds of effects at different times. And I would agree with Doug that starters, you need to find out what happens with adults in these environments. So it's just, I've been doing the space show for 19 years, and it doesn't seem like we've made a whole lot of progress.
Yeah.
And you've been doing it for longer than 19 years.
Yeah, actually, I looked back recently and found a sketch of a asymmetrical dumbbell with Moon and Mars gravity from, it was either 1985 or 87. It wasn't until really 2015 that I started to realize that the missing piece was the argument for needing to know, you know, the fact that we know 1G good, 0G bad, anything in between, we simply don't have any data whatsoever. People are complex. Human physiology is complex. If people look at slide 3, in my presentation, the real puzzlement of the question, the key part of that slide is the question mark. But the four different trajectories that show the effects of different gravity levels, those are probably all true for one or another aspect of human physiology. Any small gravity level may be enough to fix some problems, and others, a lot of relating to muscle stuff, and bones may require most of Earth gravity to get most of the benefit that you get in 1G. So we may find, for example, that Mars gravity needs half or more of the countermeasures that have been developed for microgravity, and the other half we don't need. But again, people are complex, and we really need to find out whether we have a future. And the real question to me is, how much interest is there in exploring the moon, going to the moon by 2024, if we know that we can't live there without genetic modification that turns us into a different species?
Well, there might be a lot of interest in people for tourism or other reasons to want to go there for shorter periods of time, maybe
yes.
not to live there.
Yes, and in fact, I think that the partial gravity effects in tourism, if that's a major market for millions of people, you don't want to do that on the moon. You want to do that in equatorial orbit because you can underprice anybody trying to go to the moon. Somebody, you know, do you want to have the lunar gravity and Mars gravity and microgravity experience in Earth orbit for X million dollars, or for 10 times that, you can have just lunar gravity? I think that the major market for a LEO, equatorial LEO orbit, ELEO, as Al Globus talks about it, is going to be tourism. And even if it turns out that partial gravity isn't good in the long term, there are lots of things that humans can take in small doses, whether it's alcohol, sex, TV, sleep, salt, sugar, that you can't take 100%. And it may be that partial gravity is a wonderful tourism thing, and that that's the major market for the first half dozen space facilities that are commercial. And they will probably be all in equatorial low Earth orbit.
Well, I'd like to see progress being made on that. You have a note from Tim in Dallas, and listeners, we still have time if you want to call us, 1-866-687-7223. I know we're at the bottom of the hour, but we'd still like to take your call. Tim says, should you point out before you leave the show today any other slides that we should pay particular attention to?
Slides 2 and 3, you know, there's a phrase called an earworm, and there's an analogous thing called a brainworm. I want the graphics in slides 2 and 3 to rattle around in your brain, and when you go for walks with friends and you bring this up, because these are things that we need to think about, okay? And if we think about them, we're going to start changing our plans.
All right.
Now, if you look for the later slides, if you're interested in the engineering of how you do something, you know, slide 6 has graphics, slide 7 has useful graphics. The basic concept for the asymmetrical dumbbell is shown in slide 8. Get into this, but start with 2 and 3 because those are the ones that should get your attention.
Okay. Do you see the people that want to make a commercial or private space stations? There's 2 or 3 companies. Okay, there's Bigelow and there's a couple of other companies. I forget their names. Have you talked to them? Is there a market for their commercial space station for doing this in an equatorial orbit, maybe with people volunteering to go up, just like people volunteer for bed rest studies?
I think Bigelow has an interesting focus. I don't think he wants to send rich people up. I think he wants to send civil astronauts working for companies or countries beyond the ones that launch rockets into space. And it's an interesting market. It may turn out to be a really important one. But I think that there may be more of a future in the SpaceX or Amazon, Blue Origin approaches. But Bigelow decided to not be in the launch vehicle business, but to be the destination. But he's still waiting 10 years after he thought he would have vehicles for his customers to launch on. He's still waiting for that. And a lot of things in space take a lot longer than you expect. I mean, for example, TEPSI, we came up with the idea back in 2009. I finally knew enough about what the tether needed to be like and get it wound by 2012. It was supposed to launch 2013. It just flew 5 months ago.
You have a note from Oscar in Phoenix, Arizona. And he says, Joe, is there any work being done on any of these topics or related topics outside the United States with either entrepreneurial or academic researchers of any kinds or other national space programs?
I don't know. I get my dander up and, pitch this periodically. I know that there are some folks in ESA interested, but I have not talked with them in some time. Good question, okay? And I need to look into it more. I think it's really likely to be not the usual suspects. It may be countries that want a different, there are several countries like Mexico and Poland and Estonia, I believe, have started space agencies in the last couple of years.
Romania has one, too. They've had a space agency for a while.
And yeah. I thought it was interesting that in Mexico's first project was the balloon test, the stratospheric balloon test. It was a very appropriate first test. I think that balloon tests are way better than CubeSat tests for the things that you can do with a balloon. If you're trying to get up to speed, start with balloon tests. When you're ready to go, you can launch it that day. That is not true with CubeSats. In our case, with NRL, it took 6 years longer than expected to get it launched.
For today's program, is there anything that we've omitted or forgotten to talk about or that you believe we should have talked about that this would be the time to bring it up?
I can't think of anything. I did bring up several things that I hadn't expected to talk about. One was my mini harangue on using tethers in when you have two-way traffic. Actually, let me go a little bit more into that.
Okay.
If you envision launch vehicles as being ships, you can go in any direction. That's great. If you're having regular traffic, the model that's relevant is railroads. And railroads make sense when you've got regular traffic in both directions for the same sites. And when you're thinking that way in space, that's where tethers come into play. If you can catch things and throw things back, and absorb the momentum changes, you can reuse not just your hardware, but you reuse the reaction mass. You can't do that with rockets. When you have a reusable rocket, you never reuse the propellant. You throw it away. Tethers allow you to reuse reaction mass. And once you've got traffic in both directions, that's where you need to be thinking.
You got it.
And even if it's not the whole Delta V, you know, not taking things from escape to putting them on the moon surface, even if it's only half that Delta V, it's worth doing.
You got a email from Dr. Doug. Short-term orbital tourism won't be equatorial, but rather in an inclined orbit, because a big draw for orbital tourism will be to see different parts of the world, including the home countries of the tourist. Equatorial LEO mostly goes over the ocean.
I agree that there is a real advantage, but once you start spinning, the actual view out will not be something you want to look at. And so the question is, once you have something that you're looking at on a TV screen, it can be anything you want. It can be high resolution beamed from another orbit, so it can be real time. But yes, I agree that flying over your own country where you made your first $1 billion and where you can wave to your family, even though they don't see them, yeah, that's a real appeal. But I'm not sure. Once you start finding the ability to launch people and have people stay in multiple years in ELEO, that traffic is going to be much higher than for higher inclinations. And so I think that, you know, yeah, there are people that will pay a lot more for a smaller exclusive cruise, but most of the people go on big boats and save a lot of money.
Well, I'd just like to have the opportunity for tourism. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, there is a big problem with tourism, which is something has nothing to do with space, but rather it's called the wealth equation. In the $30 million and up range, the number of people that you have to, the price that you have to drop in order to get people that have half as much money to buy your tickets, if you want to send twice as many people, if you want twice as many people with half as, with, excuse me, let me think about this. If you want to double the market, you have to reduce the price of the ticket by 42% at the high end. It changes when you get below $30 million, but right now you need to have lots of money to get into the space. And in that range, if you want to sell, you know, you can sell a ticket for a dollar, or you can sell two tickets for a total of $1.16. So you got to pay for that second tourist ride for 16 cents on the dollar compared to the first one. That is the biggest challenge connected with real tourism, is that you have to drop the price spectacularly to get more market share. And you don't get much more money for doing that. And that's the big challenge for tourism, I think, in space and anywhere else.
Well, yeah, I would agree. I think the business case is yet to be proved for space tourism.
And actually, part of the answer to that is you sell the dollar tickets to the guy that has the dollar, and you sell the 58-cent tickets to the guys that, and that's what happens in the real world. There are still first-class seats, and there are first-class cruises and all that stuff.
And then there's coach on the same vehicle.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see how they do it. But
and by the way, one of the things that I am surprised by is the fact that all seats on a launch vehicle on a Dragon 2 are the same size. That is silly, to my mind. The people sitting in the middle can be much taller and probably going to be much wider. And the idea that a Japanese-American woman 5 percentile size has the same seat that a basketball player will be using doesn't make sense.
No, but as long as they don't share my seat like they do on Southwest Airlines. I'm not planning to go on a space cruise, but involuntary seat sharing doesn't work either.
Southwest actually has an interesting rule that if you need to take two seats, you contact them and they only pay for the, you pay for the second seat if all the seats in the plane are full. If there are any unused seats, you get to use two seats for the price of one.
That's kind of like partial seats, right? Like partial gravity or something like that.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that. Next time I have to share my seat with someone, I'll remind them to request a second seat.
Yeah.
Probably be one of those famous Southwest fights that starts as a result of saying that, but who knows. Anything else, Joe? Have we exhausted your gravity capabilities?
You've drained my my harangues.
Well, I hope we can do this again, and we'll be able to talk about some tangible results and some experiments or some information that's been done or is actually getting ready to be launched and done. And I don't know, maybe one of these rocket entrepreneurs will take serious to this and
I would
and
very much like
to
that
it.
To happen.
I mean,
they don't have to tell me that they're doing this. You know, one of the companies has expressed interest. I don't know whether the others will. I don't know whether we'll see.
Well, we'll see, but they should take an interest in it, and I hope they do it. So,
yeah,
Joe, we thank you very much for sharing nearly 2 hours with us tonight, and I will archive the program and get it to you, get you your copy of it, and do well, and I hope we can talk to you again down the road and push this all forward.
Very good.
Thank you, listeners.
We thank you
for your emails, Doug. Thank you for your call. Remember, it's a full week on the Space Show Monday, Tuesday, Hotel Mars on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. So everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Joe. Goodbye from David and the Space Show.